All right, okay, here, now, let's do the real stuff here. It's a little bit after 8 o'clock, and welcome to the program. It's the Mornings with Ed show. And, you know, I just get lost in conversation with Laureen before we go on every single time. So please welcome WealthWise Financial Services President and CEO, the award-winning Laureen Gilbert. Thank you, Laureen, for being here.
Good morning, Ed. Good morning. Great to be here. And it's so exciting to hear about your house and your move, and I'm so happy for you.
I cannot tell you how much I appreciate that. I was explaining to you off air I feel stupid for feeling this way. Of course, home ownership in Laguna Beach, what could be better than that? I'm kind of losing a little bit of a view that I loved as a renter. So, yeah, but I'm making up for it. I'm the great what's the word? I'm compensator, I guess.
Right.
And I'm bringing kayaks and paddleboards with me every day to work, and I'm going to enjoy the beach here.
Gotta love that. You know, I have a similar story because I was in North Laguna for many years, and then I moved up to Mystic Hills. And, you know, I was, two blocks from the beach in North Laguna, and now I'm a mile up in Mystic Hills. And I was, you know, worried about that, concerned about it. Like, oh, I'm no longer, you know, two blocks away. But I have to say, I adjusted very well and actually love Mystic Hills and love it's very quiet. So, you know, there's always a trade-off,
right,
Ed, in purchasing a home and making that move. But I think it's a very exciting move for you. And happy for you.
Why, thank you so much. That means a lot to me. It really does. And by the way, so not just a great move, you know, not, you know, just home ownership, but I get this amazing kitchen now. In the old place, I could actually touch one kitchen wall to the other with my hands reached out. But now I get an amazing large kitchen with counter space. I don't have to share the kitchen counter with my office counter and have a copier,
right,
on it, you know? So, yeah. A little more room. That's kind of cool.
And now you can try some new recipes.
Yeah. Yes.
New...
Yeah. I'm actually going to ask you for your recipe on those morning muffins that you make. Yeah. That'll
yeah,
be my
biscotti.
First biscotti.
Yes. I've already had my biscotti this morning. That a homemade biscotti. I
love hearing that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again, Laureen. I really appreciate that. Something I read on your website, actually, that caught my eye, and I'd love for you to explain it to the listeners, and that's a word that I haven't heard in a while, and that's stagflation.
Right. So stagflation is a combination of stagnation and inflation. And what the risk is an environment that has slow growth, so that's the stagnation part, and high inflation. And we know we've heard about inflation over this last year. And what we've seen is, and we've talked about this before, is that we've really peaked in growth. And now those growth numbers are coming down. And so as GDP comes down, but inflation remains in place, the question is, are we at risk for a stagflation environment? Along with the other part of stagflation is a persistently high unemployment rate. And what we've seen with unemployment has come down dramatically to double digits, down to 5.2%. But the labor participation rate has been stubbornly at this 61.7%. And that is a concern. And what we've seen with the labor participation rate is that we still haven't had enough Americans really re-enter the workforce. We know there are 10 million jobs that are available, but that Americans aren't necessarily rushing to go back to work. Now, my theory in all of this is that as soon as the economic stimulus of that increased unemployment insurance goes away and expires at the end of September, we'll automatically see people going back to work. Now, counter that, where I think we're still going to have a weakness, Ed, is with women going back into the workforce. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that, you know, the school situation is still uncertain, still stressful for many families. The kids going back to school and what's going on, are they back? Are they home? What are they doing? And the other reason is that with the additional stimulus of $300 per child that is going out to families, certain families, depending on your income levels, that is going to keep a lot of women still home. So where we really, the bottom line in all of this is, I think we should be looking at the possibility of stagflation. However, our economic growth numbers are still very high, much higher than they were pre-pandemic, so they're still high. Where we need to be concerned is that labor participation rate and helping people get, you know, kind of how do we increase that? How do we get people back to work?
Would you agree that part of that, the problem getting labor, the labor participation rate up, is also the fact that the new Delta variant is causing havoc across the country? And during the initial pandemic in 2020, that employees were finding that maybe coming back to work in the restaurant or coming back to work in close quarters was just too dangerous for now, and we're still finding that.
Absolutely. The Delta variant really is the reason for this slowdown with the economic growth side of things, and yet inflation still remaining high. So, you know, we haven't lost the consumer, and that's good. I mean, consumer may be slowing down a little, but we haven't lost the consumer completely. But the other thing I would say, as far as labor participation rate, this is something that we faced pre-pandemic. We still were struggling with our labor participation rate. And that actually means we need immigrants, qualified immigrants coming into the United States who can fill jobs here, because we're not able, we should be able to fill more jobs with the people that are unemployed. But we also, in addition to that, need skilled labor coming into the United States to bring up our labor participation rate.
Okay. But what happens if Congress doesn't raise the limit on federal borrowing soon? What are the possibilities? What could we see if that doesn't happen?
Well, what we've seen in the past is that could cause a shock to the market, Ed, actually. That, you know, we're looking right now and warning investors that we expect a correction between now and the end of the year. That's technically, that means a 10% pullback in the markets. And we never know what the impetus is going to be. What's the catalyst that's going to be for that? But something like the debt ceiling being reached and they can't come to an agreement could absolutely cause the next correction. Now, remember, corrections are normal. We actually see that as a buying opportunity in this market because we still are in a bull market run. But if Congress doesn't come to an agreement, people will not be paid, you know, government workers, that's the concern. And that could have this ripple effect into the private sector, and we could have the markets go into a correction territory. So those are some of the implications. But ultimately, Congress will figure it out. It's just a matter of when.
Okay. Retirement accounts would take a beating. The value of the U.S. dollar would erode, essentially. And let me ask you about the percentage here and if there's a fine line. Okay, so you say that 10% is a normal correction
It's
a number we could expect. If it's 20%, is that beyond correction? Is that a problem area?
Well, that's when we start to consider that being 20% or more that's sustained is really more of a recessionary concern. And, you know, that's what we experienced March of last year of 2020. And we are not expecting that because we still are in the mid-cycle of the economic growth. So we're not in a late cycle situation. So we still think that we are far away from more of a recessionary environment, where in a recession, you're contracting. Instead of growing the economy is contracting. We're far from that.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. And something that maybe you can explain to me, because I really, as much as I try and absorb it and get cryptocurrencies, there's just some things about it I'm not getting. And even though you can buy things with cryptocurrencies, it's not the same as cash. I always thought it was kind of the same as cash. So it can be taxed. The IRS can tax cryptocurrencies?
Well, not only can they tax cryptocurrency, they're now, with this newest legislation, they are requiring the crypto market to report earnings. And that's what makes it easy for the IRS to track what is owed. And that's a great move because it, of course, needs to be taxed. Any kind of gain is supposed to be taxed. Now, people avert that in many ways. And by the way, even now with Venmo and those kinds of payment systems, now the IRS is saying, just like anything that's $600 or more, they're going to consider that earnings when people are making transactions. So, you know, the IRS says, hey, Uncle Sam says, we want to be paid. And so they are trying to update their capabilities as these new payment systems have been put in place.
Okay. Thank you for that. I was reading recently that BlackRock started offering investment products to individual Chinese investors as the country's first entirely foreign-owned fund management firm. Why are some saying that pouring billions of dollars into China is now a tragic mistake?
Well, we've seen
and is it? I'm sorry. And is it a tragic mistake?
We've seen that there are concerns about the Chinese government and their involvement in the markets. And so we've seen that this year, in fact. And so we also have known for decades that it is hard to know. There isn't the same kind of regulatory environment and transparency that there is in other parts of the world, Europe, the United States, other places. So they don't have the same kind of accounting standards. They don't have the same kind of transparency. And with that, you know, so on BlackRock's side, they want to be an early adapter and an innovator, and they want into the Chinese markets because it is a huge opportunity for all of the investment management firms to have a foothold there. However, the risk to BlackRock, as well as to investors, is the ongoing structural issues that are there in China. So it's a bold move on BlackRock's part, but, you know, only time will tell if it will end up being positive and profitable for them.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And I want to check back with you in a couple of months and see how that relationship is working. I'd love to keep tapping in on that one. Life insurance. Of the many things that you and your company offer your clients, life insurance, I never really even thought of it this way. And I guess a lot of people don't think about life insurance really until it's time. But I'm wondering, does everyone need it? Every individual? Do we need life insurance? Who needs it specifically? And tell me about life insurance, essentially. How long should your life insurance policies last? What should someone look for?
Great question, Ed. And most people have a need for life insurance their entire life. But the type of insurance that they utilize will depend on where they are in their life stage. So when you're young and you don't have much in assets, but you have people who are dependent upon you for your income. For instance, maybe you have a young family and children, and at that stage, you don't have, most people at that stage don't have a lot of wealth. So we use life insurance as a way that if the unexpected were to happen and somebody passes away, that the family would be okay, that there would be money. Many times, that is term insurance that is available for a specific period of years, 20 or 30 year term, that gets you through that hump of you don't have money when you're younger, you're building your wealth. If something were to happen during those years, your family would still be taken care of, And term insurance is very inexpensive for the amount of coverage that you get because it's only for a limited period of time and it goes away. And the difference between temporary insurance like that and permanent insurance that lasts forever is, the analogy is, it's the difference in renting a house versus buying a house. And you're in the process of that right now. So, you know, owning your home has a benefit over the long term. Owning permanent life insurance has a benefit for the long haul. If you're going to hold your life insurance for your lifetime, and if you're looking at it more over your entire life, then that actually becomes the less expensive way to buy life insurance. It costs more in the shorter term, but provides more in the longer term. And we use permanent insurance like that for estate planning needs. And that's something that right now at the end of the year that we're looking very closely at. Why? We think the cap, that exemption on the estate tax, is going to go down. Right now it's over $11 million per person, almost $12 million per person. So, you know, around, if you're married, $24 million. That's a lot of exemption that people have right now. That could go down back to, you know, $5-6 million per person. Could even go down to three. Who knows? But that could change. It's set to sunset in 2026. It's going back to that indexed amount, which will be about $6 million a person, or Congress could actually bring it down even further. So in that case, you're buying the insurance to pay for the estate tax, and you want that insurance out of your estate as well. So we put it in an irrevocable life insurance trust. It stays out of your estate. You're buying the insurance so that your beneficiaries have a way of paying the estate tax. And right now, we're working on a lot of cases like that. So, Ed, if people have a taxable estate or are concerned that the estate tax exemption is going down, they should give us a call and talk to us, because now is the time to be looking at that kind of life insurance.
Oh, you're good. You're good. How do we find you? That was good. Beautifully explained, by the way. Thank you. I think I just have one question before I ask you how we find you and stuff. So let's say you have sufficient assets to provide your survivors with everything they need for all of the major expenses for years to come after you're gone, mortgage, education, healthcare, all of that stuff. Life insurance? Not life insurance.
I would say insurance, but focus on the things that you may need, like long-term care insurance or disability insurance, that people tend to be underfunded with. And that is, has a much greater risk than oftentimes just dying. If you were incapacitated and you couldn't work, that is disability insurance, or long-term care if you had a need where you need help. So those are the other types of insurance that are just as important.
There are reasons Wednesdays are among my favorite days. How do we find you, Laureen Gilbert?
949-748-1177 or wealthwisefinancial.com.
Always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for taking the time with us this morning, Laureen.
Thank you, Ed. Have a great rest of your week.
Thank you. You as well. 821 The Time. It's the Mornings with Ed Show.